From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with Listen, the podcast that highlights the common threads that run through different cultures and unite us as human beings. We're thrilled to bring you another conversation in our series on writers and writing. In today's interview, we'll be talking about written fiction and what it looks like going into the third decade of the 21st century, from independent presses to online publishers. We'll also take a look at flash fiction, that most distilled form of prose. My guest, J. Edward Croft, was an actor who became a writer, who became a psychoanalyst, who is now a writer and a psychoanalyst. He currently takes flying lessons. His mostly flash fiction stories have appeared or are forthcoming in over 30 online and print journals, and he is editor-at-large at Trampset. He lives with his husband, Mike, and their adopted Siberian husky, Sasha, in New York City and the Catskills of upstate New York. You can find him on Twitter at J. Edward Croft. J. Edward Croft, welcome to the Listen podcast.
Thank you, Kate. I'm really thrilled to be here.
I hope you don't mind if I call you Joey. You will always be Joey to me, as we met when we were 18 years old, studying theater at New York University. And in fact, this is the first time we have spoken since we graduated in 1993, I would love it if you could catch me up a little bit on your journey from actor to writer.
Yes, and absolutely, please call me Joey. If you were able to tolerate my college self, then you have earned the right to call me anything you like. One correction in what you said is that actually, and I guess maybe you didn't know this, I had to drop out of NYU after my sophomore year. That's when I left Strasbourg, which was the studio that we were studying at, due to family issues. And it was about a year and a half before I was able to go back. And when I went back, I actually went back to the Gallatin School of Individualized Study, and that's where I graduated from in 96. That's part of the journey, though. And apropos of your question, so that year and a half between leaving school and then going back, I acted professionally in New York, and it left a really bad taste in my mouth. I grew up in Washington State doing regional and community theater starting at the age of 8. And it was, for me, it was the bond that I formed with every cast that I was in those early days that really was the heart of what I loved about the theater. We became a family. I mean, I used to bawl at the closing of every play, because it felt like my family was falling apart. And when I started working professionally in New York, it wasn't that at all. My fellow actors were competing against me and trying to get their name bigger on the title or whatever. And that was really disheartening to me. And so what happened was, the last thing that I did, I said, you know what, I need to take a break, because I don't want the thing that has always been the joy of my life to become something that I hate. And so officially, I guess I'm still on that break. I never officially said I'm leaving acting. I just said, but it's been, you know, almost 30 years, and I'm still on that break. So who knows? Maybe there's renaissance at some point.
And Joey, I want to just take a moment to mirror something back to you, because, when we met, we were just a few months out of high school, and I think it must have been our very first day at the Strasbourg Institute, which was the studio where we studied and where we met. And I remember we were in Hope Arthur's class, and that was a Monday class. So I actually wonder if this was our very first day at the Strasberg Institute, because she gathered us on, you know, in the performance. It was a black box theater, so it was, you know, on stage in the performance area. She gathered us in a circle, probably 15 of us or 12 of us or however many. And we went around in a circle, and she asked us, you know, why we were there. Why did you decide? Why did you choose theater? Why did you choose NYU? And why did you choose Strasberg? And I, after all these years, I remember your answer, and it really has a lot to do with what you just said about experiencing, you know, each production in a very intimate way with your, you know, and forming these close bonds with your class, with your castmates. Because you said that very thing on that day. You said, what I love about the theater is the energy on the stage, and that, you know, that wonderful energy just zinging between each of the performers. And I remember what you said is, you said, you know, I think a lot of people, when they think about theater, they think it's something like the energy is zinging between the actor and the audience. And you said, for me, the audience is almost incidental. You know, it's really just about what's going on stage, and the audience is out there witnessing that wonderful thing that's happening on stage.
Oh, what a wonderful memory. I don't remember saying that specifically, but it's nice to know that I'm at least consistent because, yeah, I mean, that's still really where I am today in thinking about it in retrospect. So it's really interesting that you have that memory, and that it's, yeah, that it is in keeping with exactly what it was all about for me, and why ultimately, when it became a job, it became something other than that, and it's what really again led me to my 30-year hiatus, or almost 30-year hiatus, mm-hmm. And part of that was then what brought writing more into focus, because that had been such a concentration for me since I was 8 years old, that there was kind of suddenly this void. And I'd always written, that had always been sort of a sideline thing. In fact, I was, you know, in thinking about our conversation, I hearken back to the very first story I remember writing, and I was in first grade. And I got in trouble for something, and my mother sent me to my room as my punishment. And I had on my desk in my room it was a plastic, all caps, manual typewriter. And and I don't remember who got it for me, but somebody must have known something that it was given as a gift, I remember. And so I decided I'm gonna use this banishment time and write a story. So I wrote a story called The Little Italian Boy. And the story of The Little Italian Boy is he gets in trouble and is sent to his room as his punishment.
Okay.
But he decides he's going to jump out the window and run away. And shortly thereafter, his mother comes to check on him and finds him gone and becomes hysterical. And she starts running through the streets, wailing and weeping and calling his name. And finally finds him on the steps of the church. And she hugs him and kisses him and says, "I'm so sorry. I will never send you to your room again. And, you know, by the way, why don't we go get gelato?" So, you know, I learned at sort of an early age to live vicariously, you know, through characters, whether it was writing or acting, because I didn't have the guts to run away, but the little Italian boy
right.
did. And that was just sort of a thrilling thing. Sort of an interesting thing about it is I didn't tell my mother about the story. I actually brought it in to my first grade teacher and gave it to her the next day, who then informed my mother about it. And of course, my mother wanted it. And my first grade teacher refused to relinquish it. She says, "No, Joey brought it to me and I'm keeping it." And it wasn't until my younger sister graduated from high school that then she gave the copy to my mother some, you know, 20 years later. And it's now framed on my on my mother's living room wall. But so that was a very, you know, early example of the sort of the power of writing and being able to express what I couldn't necessarily do myself, but I could inject it into into this character. And so all of this, you know,
and
ultimately
what was the style of what you were writing, Joey? What was it? I mean, was it like a short story, or was it a play, or it sounds like it wasn't a poem. I mean, what did it look like?
Yeah, The Little Italian Boy was, and it was all phonetically, you know, again, I was in first grade, so it was all phonetic. You know, I think Italian was U-Y-T, you know. I mean, it was maybe 100 words, you know. So actually, that's an interesting question because I hadn't thought of it. I guess that was my first piece of flash fiction. It was, you know, I mean, it's on one little piece of paper.
What is flash fiction exactly? Because, I mean, before I reconnected with you, I had never even heard that term. So can you define that for us? What is flash fiction?
So it is loosely defined, and I think it is a relatively newish term. And in fact, since flash fiction, there's microfiction, there's 10-word fiction. They've minnowed it down even further. But loosely defined, it's 1,000 words or less. Some publications now are even reining that in and saying 750 words or less. So you have to sort of look at submission guidelines and see which publication is how that particular publication is defining it. But yes, that's how it's loosely defined.
And I'm curious, when you write, when you sit down to write a piece of flash fiction, is it that brief when you begin, or is it kind of like a big slab of marble? You know, you just put everything on the page and then you go back with a scalpel and define those 1,000 words or those 750 words.
So, you know, my method is, I'm an embarrassingly sporadic writer. I can go weeks or even months without writing. And I've learned over time that I just have to accept that about myself. Because if I try to force it, it doesn't work. I know there are writers who say, no, write every day at the same time. And even if it's awful, just write it as an exercise. I can't do that because I will find a million excuses as to why I, you know, need to do laundry right now. Believe me, my house is the cleanest house on the block when I'm trying to force myself to write. Because I would like to do anything but that. I kind of have to be in the zone, and when I am, I can dash out a story beginning to end, revise it, and even send it out in a single day. That's just sort of the way I work. In general, I will know in my mind almost when I start, I'm like, yeah, this first draft is going to be 1,200 words. The interesting thing, and what I found over time, is that my favorite part of the writing process, because the actual composing for me can be quite agonizing, it's the editing that I really enjoy the most. Say I write a story that's 1,200 words, I get kind of excited that I'm like, oh, now I get to, you know, edit out at least 200 of those. And I know that sounds strange to a lot of people, but it actually makes me a little bit giddy when I'm like, okay, I've got the draft and oh, I got 200 words I get to edit out. This has been a thing that I've been thinking about a lot since going back to writing, because I took a break from writing for a number of years as well, is the way, at least in the United States, or at least the way I was taught about writing, particularly say in high school and even college for that matter, is entirely wrongheaded in my view. We seem to have in the United States anyway, this more is more model. And I just think that's so wrong, right? We're always given word minimums, right? You know, so this essay has to be at least 1,000 words or 2,000 words or whatever it is. And of course, all that really resulted in was increasingly bad writing, because we all, at least I did, made sentences that were twice as long as they needed to be to get to the word capacity. But I was never, in my memory, right, in high school or in college, ever said, here's your word maximum. Tell this story in 500 words. And I think that's just, it's a more compelling way of looking at writing and really being like, what is necessary and what is not? In many ways, it's much harder to write a rounded beginning, middle, end story in 1,000 words as opposed to 30,000 words. Now, don't get me wrong.
Right.
Certain stories absolutely require 30,000 words or 60,000 words, and that's fine. But many don't. And I think that the lack of editing is not a great thing.
I mean, I guess I can sort of imagine how that happens, at least in the American educational system, which is what you and I are both most familiar with, which is, you know, you're dealing with a 12-year-old or a 15-year-old or a 17-year-old who, you know, if you don't give them a minimum, they're going to give you a paragraph. You know, not every student, of course, but I can imagine that for a lot of teachers, it's like, you know, if you don't tell them 15 pages, they are sure as hell not going to give you 15 pages. But at some point, you're right. I mean, that should be part of the process. You know, you should be able to get those students to a point that you can then start talking about economy and the joy of editing and, you know, finding pleasure in where am I going to trim back those words? Because there is joy to be found in that. I can totally imagine that. I remember, and I wonder if you remember, that in that same class that I referenced before, in Hope Arthur's class at the Strasberg Institute, for our scene work, we were given, well, I don't actually know if we were given, if we were assigned these texts, but we were told to find short stories by Dorothy Parker, and with our scene partners, we chose those stories, and then we used them, we put them on their feet in front of our classmates, and we used them to, as scene work. First of all, I'm curious if you remember that, and I'm very curious if those texts influenced you in any way as a writer.
I really love this question on so many levels. One, because it harkens us back to those days in Hope Arthur's class. And Hope, I have to say, what a marvelous character she was. Have her, yes, it was Monday. It was Monday mornings. Actually, it was Monday kind of all day with her, I think. And she always showed up late. And she would come in, and if we weren't already doing our relaxation, she's like, why aren't you working? I don't know if you remember, but I used to do an impression of her when she would, like, because she always did this backheaded laugh that was soundless, right? And I just adored her.
Oh, yes.
And if you remember,
her ashtray?
Well, that's exactly the memory that I wanted to share. Exactly. Yes, she in class, and it was in the Marilyn Monroe, the Marilyn Monroe Mini Theater in the Black Box on the first floor of Strasberg and behind red doors. And yes, she smoked these really long brown cigarettes. I think they were called Moore 120s, if I remember correctly. And yes, she would bring her ashtray that was the form of a house. And if she rested the cigarette in the open front door, then smoke would come out of the chimney. Yeah, as I'm saying this, that's got to be in a story sometime soon. I mean, that ashtray, if nothing else, has got to find its way into a story soon. So, yes. I do remember her. I remember having to purchase the Dorothy Parker reader for that class. By the way, I adore Dorothy Parker, and in fact, one of her, she's most famous for her quips, and one of them really sums up my relationship with writing perfectly, which is, I hate writing, but I love having written. And that just resonates with me on so many levels. So I do remember having to buy the Dorothy Parker reader, but as you were sort of saying, I don't remember what story or stories even that we did. What I do remember, however, is pairing up and doing the dialogue of the man and the woman from Hemingway's Hills Like White Elephants. And that absolutely went completely over my head. I mean, it was decades later that I reread a lot of his short stories. I had no idea when we were doing the dialogue in Hope's class that the man was trying to convince the woman to have an abortion. I mean, I had absolutely no idea at all. And so in that way, in fact, it was quite influential because I did go back decades later and read a lot of his short stories. And, you know, I don't think that the term flash fiction existed during Hemingway's time. But the truth is, that's what he was doing. And he was an absolute master at it because he was so good at saying so much in so little, which is an absolute requirement in flash fiction. You know, the economy just demands that. But also, he was so good at knowing that what is not said is every bit as important as what is said, right? Hills Like White Elephants, I mean, abortion is not a term that is used at all, and yet that's what the entire story is about, right? And that really is the essence of the short form.
Yeah, yeah, it's so interesting because I don't remember doing any Hemingway. I don't remember that title at all. I'm going to have to go back and reread that story. But that's exactly what I remember about the Dorothy Parker, that it was all about what is not said and how you communicate that truthfully on stage without, as Hope would constantly say, without indicating. I remember when we were, someone would be waiting. She would talk about, you know, how do you wait for someone on stage? And no one was ever allowed to look at their watch. If anyone looked at their watch, she would say, you're indicating, stop.
Yes.
Well, listen, Joey, we're going to have to take a pause for a quick break, but we'll be right back to continue our conversation.
Listen is sponsored by RAF, cutting-edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit www.rafsanpedro.es. That's www.rafsanpedro.es.
This is Kate Jetmore with Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest today is J. Edward Cruft, who is talking about his writing career. I'd love to pick your brain a bit about the current state of the publishing world. Can you talk about the move towards small and independent publishers?
Yeah, I think it's been really a necessary move. You know, if you think about it, traditional publishing houses have relatively few boxes in which writers can be put. You know, literary fiction, romance, sci-fi, young adult, whatever. And there are more. I mean, I don't want to minimize what they do. But I think what online and independent publishers are able to do is really blur those lines. And in fact, kind of work against having boxes at all. In fact, one of the fairly well-known online publishers is actually called Bending Genres, you know, and the idea of it can be literary and it can be fantastic and it can be sci-fi and, it all together. And I think that that's what online and independent publishers has sort of offered us. It's fairly well known that publications like, say, The New Yorker have a quote unquote New Yorker story. You know, it's a New Yorker story, and that's fine. Right. You know, I mean, it's fine to sort of have a thing that you're looking for. But I think that it's a wonderful thing to have something that doesn't fit neatly, that's not so definable, and to sort of open that up to have room for both.
It's wonderful as a reader to tap into those kinds of publications or, you know, sources of art or information. Because just as you said with the New Yorker, when you open the New Yorker, you kind of know what you're going to get, which is wonderful. If, I mean, I subscribe to the New Yorker. I love the New Yorker. But I also love going to a movie that I haven't seen the trailer for and just being surprised. You know, you don't know what you're going to get. It could be anything, which is exactly what you're describing.
I think that is so right. I think that's so right. And I, you know, I in addition to being a writer, I have recently become editor at large at an online journal called Trappist. And we really, so in that regard, I'm a reader. And there's the editor-in-chief and there are four of us who are editors at large. I think we all are looking for that unusual, for that thing we haven't seen before that can't be neatly put in a box, that is not so easily defined. And that's what gets us all really going. You know, we're spread across actually the world, the editors. And so it's all done virtually through messaging and Twitter and things like that. And, you know, there's sort of a chain reaction when we get a submission that the editor-in-chief sends to us and we go, oh, wow, I've not seen this before. This is so cool. Mm. And, you know, I write pretty very straightforward sort of literary fiction. I'm not a sci-fi person. I'm not a fantasy person. And yet when I get one that resonates with me, it doesn't matter what the genre is. It's like, this is just good. This has to have a home. And if we can give it that home, excellent.
And what is the common element to a piece of writing that resonates with you, whether it's sci-fi or whether it's, you know, kind of classic literary fiction? What do they all have in common?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I don't know that I've thought about. You know, it's visceral for me. I generally know within the first paragraph whether this is going to work for me or not. I mean, obviously, there's some basic stuff, right? I read a story recently that came through, and you know, the sentence before gets contradicted in the next sentence, right? It was something about, you know, they're wearing gloves, and then talks about, you know, her fingertips touching the glass or something like that. And I thought, you know, if you can't read your own stuff with a fine eye, then I can't be bothered. You know, I sometimes have a little lack of patience with things like that. It's like, don't send me something, because this is the way I work. You know, I do not send out anything unless it's my A team. You know, I have far, far more stories that are on my hard drive that will never see the light of day because it's not... it's not ready. It's not ready for prime time, so to speak. You know, I'm a huge Elton John fan, and Elton John, his B-sides on all of his singles never appeared on his albums because he said, if we feel that this is a B-side, then why would it be on an album? And that's sort of the way I feel about my writing. Right. And I have far more B-sides, that again, will never see the light of day than I do, you know, the A side.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of par for the course too. I mean, if you just think about nature, even, I mean, when you seed a garden or, any sort of creative endeavor or any sort of living thing, most of them don't ever come to fruition. They don't see the light of day, you know? I mean, even if you think about like human conception, I mean, think about all the eggs that are never fertilized or all the sperm that never end up fertilizing an egg, you know? It's just, there's just this, you know, bottomless pit of possibilities, you know, things that might take root. And then, you know, so you just have to put it out there. And then the things that do take root are really worth your time and worth your attention.
That's a great analogy, actually. Yeah, I love that. And I think that's part of, you know, some writers unfortunately send out all their sperm and probably shouldn't. And that's something that for myself personally, I try to, you know, to refrain from, that it's really only, you know, I only want to put out, and, you know, and fortunately, that has had its own rewards. I mean, I knock on wood, I have yet to send out a story that hasn't, ultimately been published. Now, it may have taken years and, you know, dozens of submissions for that to happen, but eventually it's they've all found a home. And I'm not saying that, you know, in a braggadocious way, but in a way of saying that that, I think, is about my selectiveness in terms of, no, I'm not, you know, for every story that's been published or that's been sent out and been published, there are five that are on my hard drive and will remain there probably forever. You know, every once in a while, I will think of a story and think, oh, you know, let me go back and see about that. And, you know, 2 years later, look at it and say, oh, you know what? This is what was missing, or this is what was wrong. And I fix it and do send it out. But that is the vast minority of the many, many stories, whether just started or completed.
Yeah. It almost sounds like you have an internal, like a very strong internal editor that maybe some other writers don't have, or they depend on an editor who's, you know, a completely different human being.
I think actually I'm an editor at heart. I think I'm probably more of an editor than I am a writer in a lot of ways.
Well, I just wanted to take a step back because we were talking about, you know, the fairly recent move to, you know, small publishers, independent publishers. You also mentioned, you know, the online version. Can you talk a little bit about, there's been a move towards small and indie publishers, and obviously in the last, you know, 20, 25 years toward online publishing. Can you do a little bit of compare and contrast with those publishers that have remained in print and those that are sort of solely online, and, you know, who has what to offer nowadays?
Well, I mean, again, going back to the New Yorker, not to pick on them because I subscribe as well and I love them, but you know, even they are online now. I mean, they still have a print version, of course, but you can get everything online, and I get like daily emails from them, you know, highlighting something. So, I mean, I think it's ubiquitous really now. But yeah, there still is obviously a big difference between the New Yorker and say, you know, a small online publication or an independent press. But I do believe there is not only room for both, but I think that both are kind of necessary. You know, most online presses and independent presses have a shoestring budget, if they have a budget at all. But that allows for a would-be editor to sort of cast a very broad net and see what comes in. And and then allows that editor to grow and in whatever direction they wish. You know, as I mentioned, I'm editor at large for Trampset, and that was founded by the founder and current editor in chief 3 years ago. And it was just him in the beginning. And in 3 years' time, he's added four editors at large, myself being the newest. And even in the last few months has become a paying market, which is quite quite unusual in the online publishing field. Most writers do not. But this was part of his goal when he started. He said, you know, he had a strong belief that writers, and he pays writers and the editorial staff at this point, and ought to be paid for their efforts and for their art. And to be able to have that belief and see it reach fruition in 3 years. And look, none of us are going to get rich on this, but it's an important thing. And I think that's going to continue to inform the online community. And it really is a community, by the way. I mean, there's a there's a, on Twitter, for example, there's a huge, this hashtag writing community, where none of us necessarily know one another in person, but where, you know, we really support one another and read each other's works and comment on the work and be able to share it with a larger community.
Yeah, you were mentioning the role of money in all this, and it's, money is such a strange thing. You know, it really does. I mean, beyond the obvious positive points about money, where you can pay your mortgage and pay off your car and buy food, it really does make a comment on the, you know, the value of your work. And so I can imagine that it does play an interesting role in a part of the writing world where, especially in a part of the writing world where there isn't a lot of money, you know, where editors at large generally aren't paid. If you find a place where you are paid, I mean, you suddenly are feeling like, oh, this is someone who has found a way to show me how much they appreciate me and how much my role is, you know, necessary and valued.
That is so right on. I mean, as you know, I'm my day job is as a psychoanalyst, so I deal a lot in symbolism. And so, yeah, even if it's, you know, a relatively small amount of money, to be offered that, just means the world.
I wanted to talk, for just a second about, cause you've talked about, you know, publishers on and offline, as a writer and as an editor. What about as a reader? What are you noticing nowadays with, you know, the different platforms and the different ways that we access our reading material? I just love to pick your brain for a second about what you think, which of the changes that we're seeing when it comes to online platforms, which of those you see as positive, and which of those you see as things that you wish we weren't seeing, or that you hope will steer away from in the future?
Well, you know, I think that I'll start with the negative, because I think those are fewer than the positive, in my view. The negative are sort of the ubiquitous ones that are whether it's publishing or anything else, where, you know, the trolls and the people who are haters or things like that. And that's just going to happen in any format. But I think it's far more positive. In terms of, you know, it's just like for the writers who, you know, going back to those boxes that the traditional publishing houses have, or at least in my view, you know, the writers who, whose work probably would not find a home anywhere else, because, the traditional houses would probably read the first paragraph and reject it out of hand. Because it doesn't fit their model or whatever. And again, that's not meant as a judgment. It's fine to have models, but, you know, I think that it's great that we can expand it in this way. And for readers, it's the same. I mean, they're able to read things that they're not probably going to get off of Amazon or from Barnes & Noble. The other thing is that, you know, at least in my experience, I would say almost 100% of content is free to readers. You know, not everybody can afford a $28 hardback or a $12 softback or even a 99-cent Kindle download, right? So, you know, I mean, I would venture to guess that, you know, somebody in their 20s right now could read themselves into very old age online, never having to pay a thing and never repeating a story. And that's just with the stories that are out there right now. Forget what's, you know, going to be produced in the next 50 years. So I think there are so many more pluses than minuses.
Well, we're going to take another short break, and we'll be right back to continue our conversation with J. Edward Croft. We love your feedback. Let us know which episodes you're enjoying most and what you hope to hear in the future. Subscribe to our podcast if you haven't already. Rate, review, and share, and be sure to recommend us to your friends and colleagues. You can find us on social media and check out the new Listen blog on our website at thelistenpodcast.com. Today, we're talking with J. Edward Kruft about his experiences as a writer of flash fiction. Before we continue our conversation, I'd love to let our listeners know how they can learn more about your work. Why don't you tell people where they can find you? And we will be sure to provide a link on our website as well.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, so I have a website that's dedicated entirely to my writing. It has every story that has been published since, I think, 2012. And that's www.jedwardkruft.com. And I can also be followed on Twitter at jedwardkruft.
Okay. And as I said, we will provide all of that information on our website for people who are listening. I want to talk for a moment about your most recent piece. Well, by the time this airs, it may not be your most recent piece, but this one was published this month in Potato Soup Journal, and it's called 12 O'Clock Youngsville. And I wonder if you'd be so kind as to read it aloud for us.
Oh, I would be happy to. Just a brief bit of background about it. So I often start with titles, which I think is a bit unusual for writers. Many that I've spoken to, they'll start with a piece of plot or a situation or a character. And I've certainly done that as well. But I would say the majority of my stories have actually started with the title. And this is an example of that. I was, we've been in lockdown in New York since the middle of March. And so we've been upstate in the Catskills, and which is where this story takes place. Youngsville is the town over from where we are. And I was walking my dog the other day, I guess this is about a month ago now, and I heard the Youngsville Fire Department test siren sound. And my first thought was, oh, it must be noon, because it's always at noon that goes off. And my second thought was, I think there's a title in there. So this is that's the genesis of this story. I tend to write rather free associatively. So I started with the title and said, okay, so noon in Youngsville, what's going on? And this is the story that that came of it. So here is 12 O'Clock Youngsville.
Okay, let's hear it.
My father walks through the door. The volunteer fire department's noon alarm test announces his arrival. Mother has lunch on the table, tuna sandwich with pickle and potato salad. I am home because it is winter recess, what father insists on calling Christmas vacation. In the background, the TV is on with the low murmur of the news that's always sounding but rarely watched. I am invisible. Mother is an outline. Ted Horn broke his ankle on the loading platform this morning, he tells Mother. Oh, too bad. Edith will have her hands full now. Jerry Heth tells me he's got a guy over in Liberty who wants to sell his loader. Oh, we can't afford that. He doesn't answer. His jaw cracks as he chews. Outside, the snow builds. That is what he does, Father. He plows our neighbor's driveways with that curved orange blade fastened across his pickup. In the summer, he delivers the same neighbors firewood and mows their acres. He calls himself an entrepreneur. He likes to use dictionary words that I must look up. He tells people it's because he's a voracious reader. For a long time, I assumed he must read only at night in bed because I had never seen him lift a book. He looks at me and I think for a moment he might speak. Crack, crack, crack. He turns again to Mother. When does he go back to school? Not until the second. Well, that seems awfully long. It is. My best friend lives in Canosa Lake, which is much too far to walk to, and Mother won't drive in the snow, even if the roads have been cleared. The irony is not lost on me. Nor is the loneliness that comes with knowing I won't see my friend until school is back. Her name is Renee, and she's invisible too. The newsman mentions something about a killing spree, but it is in the city, another world. Pot roast for dinner? Mother asks Father. He tilts back his head, his thinking stance. I suppose so, he decides. He always makes his decisions seem monumental, even if they are minute. I want to shout. I want to shout pot roast or chicken a la king or grilled cheese sandwiches with tater tots. Who the fuck cares? In my reverie, I don't know I am being addressed. Where the hell did he go? Father asks mother. I look at him to tell him I'm present. Did you hear me? Still looking. I said, he's already exasperated. I don't want you lazing around during Christmas vacation. I put a shovel by the back door. Go up and down the road and see whose walks you can clear. And if they say yes, don't let them Jew you down. Everybody here shovels their own walks. He knows that. That's the culture, he himself might say. They only pay him to plow because not everyone wants to mount a curved orange blade to their pickup. See that he gets to it as soon as he's done with his lunch, he tells Mother. You'll need your boots, Mother tells me, obviating further responsibility. He wipes his mouth with the back of his hand, not just as he finishes his tuna sandwich with pickle and potato salad, but always, every day and every night. He puts his meaty hands on the table surface, about to lift himself. Well, he says before, back at it. Up now. The life of the proletariat. I do not know that word. The sound of it I do not like. I will not look it up, and I certainly will not become one. Back at 4, he tells her. Dinner will be ready, she says.
Thank you. That paints such a specific picture. I mean, that the what came to me when I read it and then listening to you now reading it out loud is just an ambiance. I mean, it just creates a it paints a backdrop, really, and then your characters live inside that backdrop. How often are you drawing on your own memories when you sit down to write?
Well, yeah, absolutely. That certainly happens. And I think that's true for all writers, if I may be so bold to speak for all writers. But it's very so much similar to what we learned at Strasbourg, right? I mean, we only have our own experience from which to draw. Having said that, at the same time, it's not autobiographical. And I think a lot of readers maybe make that mistake sometimes, that it's like, well, this must have actually happened to you. So, I mean, for example, in this the scene that I just read, that never happened to me. But at the same time, I know what it's like to be ignored by somebody whom I really want to have see me. I know what it's like to feel lonely. I know what it's like to feel isolated. I'm speaking, I realize it's probably no accident that this particular piece was written while we're in lockdown. I didn't even think about it when I was writing it, but I think there's a reason that that's the story that I told during this time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Earlier in our conversation, you made reference to this, but I just want to circle back to it because I'm very interested, and I think the people who are tuning into the conversations in our writers and writing series will be interested in this as well. And that is just to ask you directly what your personal writing practice looks like.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, we split our time between New York City and upstate in the Catskills, upstate New York. Well, we used to split our time. in the pandemic world, we are upstate now for the foreseeable future because the city is, a little bit scary at the moment. And we're fortunate enough to have this option. But even in non-pandemic times, I would say 90% of my time is spent writing in the Catskills, at my kitchen table, usually with our dog Sasha under my chair. It's such a very serene. We're on 10 acres on a lake, and it's just calming and serene and much less frenetic and chaotic than the city. So I think I just naturally am able to relax more here. And that allows me to concentrate more. As far as when do I write? How do I write? Do I write every day? Do I write every day? In my head, yes. Actually putting pen to paper or fingers to the keyboard No, I'm actually kind of an embarrassingly sporadic writer. I can go weeks, even months without writing. And this is something I've just had to accept mm-hmm. about myself. You know, I know the rule of thumb is like, no, write every day and you get that muscle memory, and just has never worked for me. I've tried to force it, and what ends up happening is I just get frustrated, and it makes me sort of hate writing. And that's not a space that I want to be in.
Wouldn't you say that that's a really important step, or a really important element in, you know, being a writer or becoming a writer, is discovering what kind of writer you are? I mean, it's similar to just being a human being, you know. You have to sort of find what works for you and then honor that, even if it doesn't work for other people.
I think that is so right. And I think that is, you know, so it's interesting. I ended up getting an MFA in fiction writing, and you know, I basically spent 2 years writing different versions of what I realize now was the same novel, because back then I was all about the long form. I'd never even occurred to me to write short mm-hmm. back then. I tend to be a rather verbose person in person. In fact, my husband has referred to me as voluminous. So the idea back then of actually being, you know, doing something brief didn't even sort of occur to me. But that MFA program was also the thing, much like the professional acting in New York. I stopped writing for a decade after that. It really just completely mm-hmm. shut me down. Mm-hmm. And I think it was exactly to your point, because I was being told, no, this is the way you must do it. This is what a writer looks like. And that wasn't me. And it took me a decade mm-hmm. to sort of finally come back to, I remember so distinctly, I was walking on a beach and remembering a novella that I had written actually back when I was at NYU. It was, you know, long before the MFA program, and going, you know, I think there was something to that. Let me see if I can find it and tweak it. And that's exactly what happened. I found it, I tweaked it, and it actually became the very first piece that I published. But I had to do it in my terms and accept that my terms are fine. They may not be the terms that other yeah. writers have, and that's okay.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this whole conversation, but certainly this last question and your answer to this last question, I feel like I can catch a glimpse of what Joey or Joe, the psychoanalyst, is like, being in a room with you as one of your clients. And I wonder, you know, what... how do those two disciplines, you know, how do those two personae that exist within you, the psychoanalyst and the writer, how do they influence each other, or do they influence each other?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, I remember being asked when I sort of transitioned from actor to writer, people would ask, well, how did that work for you? And I said, well, you know, it was really quite organic, and it really didn't even feel like a transition. In that the thing that always intrigued me most about acting was character and motivation, right? You know, so why is this character saying this, behaving in this way in this particular moment and in this particular interaction with this other character? And that's really what interests me most about writing as well, is, you know, it, taking the story that I just read. Like I said, I started with the title, and then I said, okay, so who's here? Oh, we're going to be at a kitchen table, and somebody's going to come in, and they're going to say this. And it's like, okay, and then how does the narrator react to that? I don't know if you noticed, but in fact, the narrator never speaks in that story, and even though it's his story. Mm. And, you know, and those, I tend to write rather free associatively, to use a psychoanalytic term. And so that part of it is just part of my process. And then when you move to psychoanalysis, if you think about it, it really is the study and the practice and the interpretation of character and motivation. So, you know, in a way, you could say, going back to the little Italian boy, I have been doing the same job since I was in first grade. It's just been in different forms.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that is lovely. And it's lovely to, it kind of wraps up our conversation, you know, first grade Joey and present day Joey. So Joey, this has been such a pleasure. I mean, to catch up with you and get it all on tape and share it with the world. I am so grateful that you joined us today. And I wish you and your family all the best.
And to you and yours. And thank you again, Kate, for inviting me. It put a little, in these, you know, somewhat dismal times, it's put a spring in my step to be able to do this with you. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. This concludes our series of interviews focusing on writers and writing. Many thanks to Devorah Rogers, Brooke Berman, and J. Edward Croft for their generous contributions. Next time on Listen, we'll kick off Season 7 with a series of conversations on religion and spirituality. Hope you can join us. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, which was named a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 1996. Check out our archives at thelistenpodcast.com. There are 5 full seasons waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. Lauren Lovett is our producer. Caitlin Fisher handles our social media, and Lidia Munoz Soleda writes our blog. Editing, tech support, and original music are courtesy of Lucas Munoz Jetmore. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is Listen.